people's health was a guy by the name of Dr. Francis Pottinger. Has anyone heard of Pottinger before?
Yes.
No? Yeah?
Yeah.
Okay. So you might have heard of the, it used to be called the Price Pottinger Foundation. Okay, since I think it's just called the Price, the Weston Price Foundation. I don't know why, both of them are long gone. I don't think there was any dispute or whatever. Someone decided to change the name. Anyway, what we're going to take a look at here is if the internet holds up, we'll make it all the way through. If not, I will explain the rest of the video. This is all about Pottinger's cat studies. Okay, so it's a little bit weird. It's with cats, so some people might get a little squirrely. But nonetheless, it's all about food and different types of foods with different groups of cats, and let's sort of see what happens with all of that. Okay, so I'm going to do my best here to see if the internet holds up.
While studying the theory that tuberculosis was linked to adrenal gland deficiencies, he took on the task of standardizing adrenal extracts by using adrenalectomized cats. These were the steps required to standardize the biological extracts for later use with his tuberculosis patients.
Very old video, by the way.
The cats chosen for the study were apparently in perfect health. They were kept in open-air pens with a yard 4 feet wide, 7 feet high, and 12 feet long. They were fed cooked meat scraps from the sanitarium, which included internal organ meats and bones, along with some additional raw milk and cod liver oil. According to all known standards, this diet provided an optimal amount of nutrients. The cats seemed healthy. The adrenalectomy technique had been proven appropriate. Nevertheless, the study suffered from an unexplainably high mortality rate. Then came that uncalculated twist of events. For some reason, many more cats were provided for the study than could ever have been fed using leftover cooked meat scraps from the sanitarium. So, raw meat scraps from a nearby meatpacking plant replaced the cooked meat in the diets of certain cats. Within a very short period of time, the operative mortality rate of that group dropped significantly. The raw meat-fed animals began to survive the adrenalectomy extremely well, and they continued on in a superior quality of health.
Does everyone get what's going on so far? I know the video just jumped right into it. Yeah, I used to have the other one somewhere, but I'll explain in layman's terms what's going on here. Pottinger was studying the link between tuberculosis and adrenal issues, right? And so what he was doing was he was doing adrenalectomies on the cats. In other words, he was removing the adrenal glands to see what effects it would have on the tuberculosis. Okay, that's why I say it's a little bit of a weird kind of experiment, right? But nonetheless, what started happening was he noticed that they had a very high mortality rate. Okay, so in the original group that were eating the cooked meat and all that stuff, a lot of the cats were not surviving the adrenalectomy, right? And so now here we are where they had lots of cats to feed. They couldn't really afford to feed them all of this cooked meat and take all the time. So they started feeding them raw food. And lo and behold, they started surviving the adrenalectomies more. Okay, so that's kind of what's going on here.
Pottinger had unexpectedly glimpsed a new facet of fundamental nutrition. And he was compelled to respond with a series of studies that would span the next 10 years of his medical career. To begin the study, a population of animals was selected which Pottinger aptly dubbed run-of-the-pen cats. He was not interested in physical perfection. His major concern was that his cats represent a normal sampling of animals, with the exception that cats with obvious deformities or disease were excluded. Needless to say, when people from the nearby community heard of the study, more cats were mysteriously abandoned on the Pottinger doorstep than could ever be used in the experiment. Pottinger was intrigued by what he termed heat labile factors. Or, put as an experimental question, he asked, does the cooking process somehow render food nutritionally deficient, causing eventual physiological degeneration? A basic diet was designed consisting of raw meat, viscera, bones, a small amount of raw milk, and cod liver oil. Each day, this basic diet accounted for one-third of the total dietary intake of the animals. The remaining two-thirds of the diet was the dimension of experimental manipulation. One group of cats received raw meat or cooked meat along with a basic diet. The other group of cats were given raw milk, pasteurized milk, evaporated milk, or sweetened condensed milk. Each cat's daily diet then consisted of one-third of the basic diet, plus two-thirds of the prepared food which was under study. And once assigned to a specific group, the animal's diet was held constant. Although there were two different studies, one focusing on milk and the other on meat, the results of both studies were nearly identical. Over the next 10-year period, Pottinger observed and recorded numerous physiological changes in the experimental animals and their offspring. First, you will observe the raw milk animals. They move about the pen with a great deal of agility and coordination. Notice the sheen to the fur and the normal sexual interest displayed toward the male in the next pen. As would be expected, they land on their feet when thrown in the air. The pasteurized milk-fed cats, shown here, move about the pen in a manner quite different from the raw milk cats. The cat in the foreground actually developed arthritis during the experiment. They are lethargic, much like animals in a zoo. When thrown a short distance, these animals show a slightly impaired sense of coordination. Dental deterioration was also common. Note the abscesses above the molars, the reddish cast of the gums, and the soft gingiva. With evaporated milk, there was even greater deterioration. When the study was begun, this cat was better developed than any animal shown thus far. The sweetened condensed milk-fed cats not only had their milk heat processed, but there was the addition of sugar. They are nervous animals. Again, there is marked deterioration in coordination and dental abnormalities. Notice particularly the abscesses and the purple tone to the membrane of the mouth. For a further comparison, here is another example of normal development. Notice the firm gingiva, the normal coloring tones, the beautiful broad mouth, the full jaw with obvious power. This animal happens to be a male, but the comparison is nonetheless valid. Here is another illustrative comparison. The raw milk female gets in 20 or 30 licks for every one of the pasteurized milk female, then leaps away in disgust. These were all first-generation animals, born of theoretically healthy parents, and who themselves were healthy at the beginning of the study. Disturbing as these observations might be, the impaired balance, the lack of energy, the dental deterioration, some of the most significant findings emerged as Pottinger extended his study down to the second and third generations. Almost immediately, Pottinger noticed that animals fed the raw meat diet for two generations appeared larger than the same generation of cooked meat cats. At 16 weeks, this second generation raw meat cat weighs 2,000 grams, while the second generation cooked meat animal only comes up to 1,600 grams. Compare the black kitten with this raw meat kitten. The sheen, the sparkle of the eyes, the well-developed face. Nutritional studies often look at skeletal development as a rather vital index of dietary sufficiency. This is a raw meat animal with a full, round face. A later examination of the skull showed a firmly developed zygomatic arch. The frontal sinuses were complete, and calcium content of the bones throughout the body ranged from 12 to 17% by weight. The skulls of adult cats with a long ancestry of raw food diets are surprisingly constant. Here we find the development of a second generation cooked meat animal. The head has begun to flatten and is actually smaller than the comparable raw meat cat. The skull shows the major reasons for this change. The zygomatic arch is not completed. The nasal development is somewhat irregular, and the calcium content has fallen to 10%. Third generation cooked meat animals show the most remarkable skeletal change. The skull is considerably smaller. It is flat with pointed features. The skull shows a poorly developed zygomatic arch. The bones are paper thin and soft like sponge rubber. The frontal sinuses had developed in a peculiar fashion, and the calcium content of the bones had fallen to a low 3% by weight. Activity level is another index of interest. In this pen, there is an obvious difference in activity level between the raw meat animals and the cooked meat animals. One of these cooked meat kittens actually had a broken back, resulting from a failure in development. Moving into the third generation of experimental animals, the degeneration was even more pronounced. The smaller animal is a cooked meat kitten, and is actually the oldest of the three. The kitten on the left is a second-generation raw meat cat, and the one on the right is a second-generation cooked meat cat. Here is a second-generation cooked meat mother with her third-generation offspring. She has a male body configuration. Her offspring developed nasal and ocular allergies. From this same litter came an asthmatic kitten, purportedly the first to be reported in the research literature. Again, there is marked dental deterioration, abscesses, poor coloring, and gingival irritation. Pronounced exhaustion was a typical observation among the third generation of cooked meat kittens, as well as impaired coordination. This third generation cooked meat kitten had over 24 fractures resulting from a failure in development. And finally, this little third-generation cooked meat kitten was unable to release its claws from the hardware cloth and probably would have died had not the assistant taken it down. At this juncture in the study, a most interesting development emerged. The cooked meat cats were unable to successfully reproduce after the third generation. Most were void of sexual interests, and those that had attempted to mate could only produce stillborn litters. On the other hand, the raw meat animals continued to reproduce healthy offspring generation after generation. The notion that specific nutritional factors in food may be destroyed by heat processing is obviously not far-fetched. Physiological deterioration down the generations is quite graphic.
All right, I'm going to leave it at that because he just jabbers on a little more. What do you guys think? Anyone? What do you think? I mean, apart from the warm and fuzzy kittens and all that stuff, it's a little bit disturbing. But anyway, the raw foodies love this. Raw foodists, no offense, or whatever. The raw foodists love this because the argument basically says, hey, we should all be eating our food raw. Okay, and heat destroys nutrients, etc., etc., etc. I'll talk about that in just a little bit when we talk about dehydration and whatnot. Okay, and yes, there is some validity to that, for sure. Right? Jensen would always recommend 60% of the diet being raw, or at least having a little bit of raw food with every meal. I'll talk about that when we get to a different section. Right, because I have, there's lots of other things to think about when it comes to that. Okay? A couple of things that I'm going to point out here is, first of all, these cats were fed the exact same diet over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. Okay? To try and extrapolate that onto human beings, you can't really do that 100%, because as a general population, we're all eating slightly different quantities, different types of cheeses, different types of whatever. So we can definitely say, though, that there is some truth to the matter, all right? But we can't map that directly onto human beings and say that's it. One thing I will say is this, is where, you know, you can see after three or four generations there, these cats could not even reproduce anymore, right? So reproduction just came to a grinding halt. Where do you think we are in terms of generations since we started processing foods? What generation? So we started processing foods en masse around the 40s.
Mm-hmm. First or second?
Further.
No, further.
Third and fourth is where we're at right now. Okay, third and fourth. And you know, we've spoken before about look at the sharp rise that we've started seeing in all sorts of health conditions. I'm talking across the board, right? I don't think, and I'm not talking about infectious diseases here, I don't think that we've ever been this sick as a global population before in our history. Again, I'm not talking about infectious diseases or plagues or famines or whatever. I'm just talking about generally, you know, chronic degenerative disease, yeah? We've never really had that to the degree that we've had it right now. And we saw that in the price, you know, Western price studies, where he started looking at what happened when we introduced modern food to these, you know, remote cultures and whatnot, right? So there's a lot of truth to that. And if you start looking around now, take a look at what's happening with the kids. Yeah, the children today, holy smokes. Allergies, asthma, adult onset diabetes. They don't even call it adult onset anymore. That's like now considered old school. And the reason why they don't call it that anymore is because young kids are getting type 2 diabetes and adult onset diabetes. That is an acquired illness, right? You develop that illness. It's not an autoimmune issue. It's not an infectious agent. It's not like you wake up one day and you have type 2 diabetes. You actually develop that as time goes on. And it's clearly established that it has to do with food, period. You know, doctors for the last 100 years in treating diabetes, food was always the first line of defense. Before they invented insulin and all of that other stuff, it was always food, 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 right? So we know that diet has the biggest impact on something like diabetes, which is in the top 5 killers in terms of diseases, right? And that's just one. Obesity rates. Holy smokes, a third of the global population is obese or overweight, technically speaking.
Also mental issues.
Big time. I mean, mental health issues are now becoming a lot more commonplace, but also a lot more spoken about, right? And I don't know that we had that. I mean, it's a difficult thing to really try and map out, but I don't think we had that to the degree that we are seeing it now as well. Okay, so I don't want to say that the processing of food is 100% to blame, because I think that there's a lot of other factors that tie in. But remember, I can't necessarily control what's going on with the economy. I can't really control what's going on with the environment out there. What I can control is I can control what I eat, and I can control what I do in my own life and my own home, right? And that's where I think that talking about food processing and the implications of that become a little bit more relevant in terms of health. Okay, so we'll just hop right into it here. We're talking today about food processing, food additives. I'm not gonna talk too much about food safety, right? So foodborne illnesses and whatnot, because, you know, if you get food poisoning, I don't know, don't come see me. Go to the doctor and get a diagnosis and see what it is, right? So why do we use food additives? Why do we process food? Anyone want to have a couple of guesses here? Yeah.
To extend the shelf life of
food. So extending shelf life, sure. Anyone else?
Cheaper.
Cheaper, yeah. Which is kind of interesting, right? Yeah, so I take a food and I run it through a whole factory and I add a whole bunch of stuff to it, and that's somehow cheaper than if I just had it on its own. Odd. Okay, odd. But yeah, so that's another good one. What else?
Color or taste?
Yeah, so yeah, sure, taste. I'm gonna give you a bullet point list, obviously. Taste is another one. Consumer appeal.
Yeah, I was gonna say that.
Yeah, so it needs to look a certain way. Okay, so let's roll out the list here. To improve shelf life or storage time, Isn't it interesting? The 40s was a very, very interesting time period. Very, very interesting. Just come out of the Great Depression. The World War was wrapping up. We started vaccinating en masse. Yeah, we started processing food en masse. We started adding chemicals to the fields en masse. And one other thing was the invention of the supermarket. Yeah, pre-1940s, there was no supermarket. People would go to the local market where it would be farmers, and everyone would actually gather in town to trade their goods, to buy and whatnot, and that was the city, was actually just a meeting place, that's all. Everyone actually lived outside of that. And so what started to happen was they started saying, hey, you know, we have more food now. We figured out how to create more food. We've just come out of the Great Depression, and we figured out a way that we can extend the shelf life. And we're going to put it all in a supermarket. And what was interesting is slowly they started rolling people off the land and forcing them to go to the city. And now, or you had to drive to work. Okay, so now the oil industry came in and the cars came in. Very, very interesting time period when you start piecing all of that stuff together. There was a lot of big, big things that happened that I think we're feeling that sort of reverberation now in modern times. Okay, so improving shelf life largely had to do with supermarkets, right? Now it's a little different because we get into this Costco mentality where, hey, if you want to buy five, yeah, I'll give you the sixth one for free. And it stores, right? So now you can just buy more and buy more and buy more. So it also ties in modern times more with consumerism, I think. So the second point here, to make food more available, really ties in with what we were just talking about. And, you know, as we said before, in living in city conditions here, we kind of have to do this to some degree because we're so densely populated that there's no wild food here. Yeah, we can go and forage for weeds on the sidewalk that are edible and stuff like that, but for the amount of people that live here, it's not sustainable, right? So we only have 3 days worth of food in the grocery stores. That's it. 3 days worth. If nothing comes in, that food's gone in 3 days, and that's the end of it. Which is kind of crazy to think about. So processing foods, making the shelf life more stable, and putting it in supermarkets actually means that we have access to food. To increase the nutritional value, big question mark there. So, yeah, I'm going to take the grain, then I'm going to refine it and strip it of all its nutrients, and then I'm going to add a handful back in. And I'm going to tell it to you as superior. That's what they do. Yeah, your cereals, your breads, your Wonder Breads, all that kind of stuff. Yeah, it's all enriched. To improve the flavor of food, MSG tastes great. I think that a lot of people have forgotten what actual food tastes like. So it's going to have some kind of goop and a whole bunch of sauce on it and stuff. You know, it's like, whatever happened to just a carrot? What does a carrot taste like? Again, we're not this crowd maybe, but definitely what's going on out there. To make food easier to prepare. Thinking now about my ready meals. Yeah, pop it in the microwave. My Uncle Ben's 2-minute rice. Priorities, man. It's a little weird. They did a study in the UK, and people said that it was more important to update their Facebook status than have a bowel movement in the morning. If they had to choose, right? They only had to set a certain amount of time in the morning. It was more important to have coffee, to do this, and then Facebook and whatnot, and then got to the bathroom and was like, whatever, you know, maybe I'll just get around to that when I get to work or something like that. Weird. That was like in the newspaper a couple of years ago. People don't like to cook, right? If you think back to traditional cultures would actually spend most of their waking life dealing with food in some way, shape, or form, whether it was hunting it, whether it was gathering it, preparing it, eating it, or whatever. And contrast that to modern times where for a lot of people, it's merely an afterthought. Yeah, and the quicker, you know, if I can get it done in 5 minutes, that's great. I can go back to watching my show. I can go back to doing whatever else it is that's more important. We're starting to see the implications, so look at the health of the people. To improve customer acceptance, or consumer acceptance, if you will. Again, we like to see that everything looks nice and shiny, everything is the same size, everything is the perfect color. Okay, we like to see all of that, and if it looks off, I mean, go to the organic farmer's market and then go to the store and tell me what you see that's different.
Yeah?
Everything in the store is like perfect, right? Do you think that just mysteriously happens that way?
Factory produced,
genetically engineered. They spray fumigants on things to ripen them all at the same time. You know that?
Yeah.
Most things are picked well before they're ripe. Well before they're ripe. Bananas are a great example. Mm-hmm. You pick them when they are green, green, green. Yeah, and then they put them in a giant room like this and they pump it full of ethylene gas.
Yeah.
They control the temperature. And after 3 days, they bring them to just the point of being just ripe enough so that when they put it in the store, it'll be ripe within the next 2 or 3 days. You notice how all the bananas all ripen at just the same time. You go to a banana plantation, though, it's a whole different ballgame, right? This bunch over here, oh my God, they're almost rotten. This one over here, oh, they're still green. Because it's all naturally done with the sun. And they do that with a lot of other foods as well. Okay, kiwis are another great one. Comes from New Zealand. It's like on a ship for like 2 months. Gets here and all of a sudden, whoop, hey, it's ripe. There's a hand up? No? Okay. So, when we talk about food processing, what we're going to be focused on a little later is we're going to talk about modern food processing, but people have been preserving and processing food for a really, really long time. And some of those techniques are starting to come back into, especially our circle, right? So, some natural ways that we can preserve food, right? Obviously, this has not been done since the dawn of time. Still a relatively modern invention. Refrigeration, freezing, and freeze drying. Got crazy machines now for freeze drying. Has anyone seen those? Wow, just dry it like in the blink of an eye. Those are the nutrients, dehydrates everything so that it's like super light. Great for trekking and camping and stuff like that. But those machines are like $5,000 a piece. Good little box, they get $5,000. Salting. Right, very, very, very traditional method. Still done in many parts of Asia. Right, many parts of Asia. And of course, salting and drying meat and fish and stuff like that is typically what we're talking about. Canning is another popular one. Dehydrating to the raw foodies. Pickling. And last one there, fermenting. So I'm going to talk about some of these in isolation here and just give you a few key points for each one before we hop on to some of the other stuff.
Right.
Yeah?
Is smoking considered?
I guess so, yeah. Yeah, I guess I would add it to the list. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Especially, yeah, it is. I kind of wonder, modern form of smoking, I'm not sure how natural it really is. I don't know. Because some of it has like smoke flavoring added to it and stuff like that.
I was thinking more of the
traditional way, yeah.
There's like our neighbor actually does it. I was kind of curious if he
said. So when I was working a lot and living a lot with the natives, we did a 3-week kids camp. So brought in native kids from all over Canada. We basically lived like the natives did 200 years ago. So no lighters, no matches, all flint, sleeping in debris huts that you would have to build, found slate, and starting fires with cat's tails and all sorts of cool stuff. It was really, really interesting, I gotta say. But one of the things we built was a smoker. And so the way to build a natural smoker is you have your fire over here, and you dig a tunnel under the ground. And you dig another hole over here. So you put your fire here, but on the one side you just have all of the greenwood. So the greenwood smokes, right? And of course, you can flavor it with whatever kind of wood you want. And all of the smoke gets sucked through the hole here and comes out this one. So you can cook on that fire on your slate, and you can drive all of the smoke this way. And then they would just have, you know, you just hang your fish or whatever it is that you want to smoke over the smoke. And after a few hours, that's it. And it's like dried fish or dried meat. Mm-hmm. Kind of cool. They do that a lot in Africa as well, by the way. Kind of a combination, not as much smoking, but definitely salting and curing with spices. Similar to what you would do with jerky here, but the jerky here, holy smokes, man, it's just so brutal. I'm like, what the hell did you guys do to it? It's like a national dish where I'm from, right? It's like thick cuts like that of wild meats that have all been salted and cured, and you just hang them up to dry, and that's it, and they're good forever and ever. But here it's like MSG, and you gotta add this weird soy sauce, and then you gotta do this, and then it's sugar, and then, and it's just like, wow, it's the most unnatural thing I can find. Anyway, let's talk about just a few things here, and then we'll get on to some of the fun stuff. So freezing, just some points here, I don't wanna bang on too much about it. Requires long-term use of energy. Key point here, it stops bacterial action. Okay, stops bacterial action. There will be no bacteria that will grow in a freezer. You might not kill all the bacteria, but they're definitely going to not be able to do anything because of the temperature. Allows for buying food in bulk, which again can be a good thing. No, and I think in modern times now, if you were hunting, if you were growing lots of food, and at the end of the season you would have to do something with it, one of the options is you could actually freeze a lot of it, right? Last you through the winter. Okay, so this it is a decent option. Little alteration to the food. So there is a slight loss of nutrients when the vegetables or whatever it is you're defrosting. You know, when you defrost anything, you get that drip, right? Okay, the drip is essentially cells that have burst. And anytime cells burst, they're going to lose nutrients. So people have always said we've really done a great job at figuring out how to freeze, but we're still trying to figure out how to properly defrost. So one of the big differences between freezing and refrigeration slows bacterial action down. Right? We all know that. You leave something in the back of the fridge and it's ultimately going to go rotten. Right? Not as quickly as if you left it on the counter. But if you take something, you pop it in the freezer, it's going to stop entirely, right? There will be no rotting of that. Okay, next on the list here is canning. obviously, you know, a lot of what we're doing here is we're doing canning in mason jars, so it's canning, but not really in a can, per se. How many people have canned food here before? Okay, so good few. High energy use initially. Great for long-term storage, so again, it's ideal in a sense for, you know, if you have a veggie garden or something like that and you want to preserve some of those things throughout the winter months. Food generally cook first. And so to the best of my knowledge, you can't actually do raw canning. To the best of my knowledge.
Bless you.
Transfer to sterile glass jars. And the jars are then boiled to kill bacteria, and essentially they create a seal. I know a lot of people who are doing the homesteading thing, where they're trying to be a little bit more self-sufficient, and this is a very popular technique for those people. So end of the season, they've just got hundreds of mason jars, and it's fermenting and pickling and canning just going on for days and days on end. It's pretty cool. Okay, so moving forward, dehydrating. Right, become very, very popular, especially with our crowd. How many people have dehydrated stuff before? So we can use electric dehydrators, so your Excaliburs and stuff like that. We could, you know, in a traditional sense, people would actually use sun. So your sun-dried olives, your sun-dried tomatoes, and so on and so on. And you can also get ovens now that have built-in dehydrators, which is kind of cool. I used to have one. It was really neat, actually. Just get the temperature really low. Most ovens, the lowest temperature you'll get is around 170. That's about it. You know, you'd be lucky if you can get it down to 140. And then you got to keep it going for hours and hours. So really, as the name suggests, dehydrating, we're removing water from the food so that mold and bacteria cannot grow. Right, that is the sole purpose here. Because if mold and bacteria cannot grow, obviously the food will not spoil. There is a loss of vitamin A and C, right, in dry foods due to the heat and air. Usually takes vegetables 6 to 16 hours to dry, and fruits can be anywhere from 12 to 48 hours. And last point here, and then we'll talk about some stuff, enzymes remain intact as the food is not heated. This process here is a huge component of living from a raw foods perspective. They're huge. A lot of dehydrating going on to the point where it's like a full-time job. Yeah, I find that it's just extremely time-consuming, very, very labor-intensive. Not just that, you know, a couple other points here. When I'm, you know, taking fruits and dehydrating them, what am I really doing to them? Pull out all the water, what's left over?
Concentrating the sugars,
right? Yeah, would you ever sit down and eat like 5 mangoes? I've had some people that do. Fruitarian as a client. Very interesting. Only one I've ever had in my life. Very interesting. Food journal. So, breakfast. Yeah. 4 mangoes. 40 glycemic loads. Sorry, 80. Okay, anyway. Lunch, yeah, you know, 5 apples, a couple of bananas. And she was like super overweight, thyroid issues, all kinds of stuff going on. And I was like, man, what are you doing? Anyway, it took a lot of educating. No offense to any fruitarians. So when you concentrate those sugars, you are going to land up eating more of the fruit and you're going to land up eating more of the sugar. Okay. And yes, it's fruit sugar, I get it, but if you think about it this way, from a traditional standpoint, you would not be consuming fruits all year round. And you certainly wouldn't be consuming the same amount of fruits in gargantuan portion sizes forever and ever and ever. Right? Fruits would always rotate. You might even have 2 or 3 weeks where there were berries, and that would be it. The berries are all done. Okay, and so on and so on. So that's sort of it here. I just think that it's a huge waste of time and energy, is what I personally think, because this is not a one-time Louis. It's not like, okay, there we go, you know, you got your 7 trays, and now I'm cycling the trays, and this is in here for 10 hours, and that's, so the dehydrator is just on all the time. And I think that trying to keep track of all of that stuff can be a little bit crazy on the mind. And I know because I've spoken to enough raw foodists. But anyway, not to say that it's a bad thing, just sort of look at some of the downsides there of dehydrating things. I'm more of a fan of just eating it as is, no? If you can, just eat it. You know, it's a natural state. Enzymes remain intact. So at what temperature are enzymes destroyed? 180 or? No. Lower? 74? No. Around 118 degrees Fahrenheit. Okay, so 118 degrees Fahrenheit is the temperature at which enzymes are destroyed.
Sorry, at
118.
Thank you.
Yeah. Some would say 117, some would say 115, yeah, whatever.
Fahrenheit?
Fahrenheit. So the trick with dehydrating is this, is the lower you go, right? So the lower I go, the more enzymes I keep intact, but the longer I have to dehydrate it for. That makes sense? And the longer I dehydrate it for, the more nutrient loss I get. So there's kind of like a sweet spot. And obviously different vegetables and different fruits, because of the water content and the size, they're going to be different. Right, but just some of the bit more of the intricacies there with dehydrating. Pickling is next on our list here. Uses the preservative qualities of salt and acid. So acetic acid is from vinegar. You don't have to use vinegar, by the way. Don't have to. If you get into, does anyone know who Sally Fallon is? You heard of Sally Fallon?
Yeah.
Yeah. She's like I don't know what her title is, but she's like one of the big wigs at the Weston Price Foundation. And so if you go to Weston Price Foundation, her cookbook is like next level stuff, man. I think you get it here. It's called Nourishing Traditions. Hands down, one of the best cookbooks. It'll take you a little while to get your head around all the stuff. But what she does a lot with her pickling and with her fermenting and stuff like that is actually use what's called a whey starter. So you would essentially take yogurt or something, run it through cheesecloth, and all the whey would drip out, and that's your starter culture. So you mix it with the vegetables, you put the salt in, and that will essentially pickle it. Okay? So much more of an old school, very, very traditional way of doing it. Modern pickling, we typically would use salt, vinegar, and water, and you just throw everything in there and off you go, with spices and whatnot. So acid environments inhibit bacteria. That's how this is a food preservation method. I mean, this is just a small example of what's being pickled. If you go to the hipster restaurants, they're pickling everything that they can these days. Pickled shoelaces. They're doing the same thing and fermenting anything that they can. Pickled cucumber is our traditional pickles. Okay, so you just go down to the store and get pickles, that's what they are. But beans, beets, eggs, small fish, so pickled herring is a very popular dish in Scandinavian countries. And so on, and so on. Pickled onions, also very popular. Okay, next on our list is fermentation. Again, making huge waves with our crowd. People are experimenting with fermenting everything. I've gone to farmers markets now where there's fermented hot sauce, fermented mustards, fermented everything. Fermented cod liver oil. Yeah, you seen that?
Anyone?
What's that?
I take the skate.
Yeah? Do you think you can ferment oil?
The liver's fermented, not the oil.
Huh?
The liver is what's fermented, not the oil.
I have very mixed feelings about that. I read a huge report on fermented cod liver oil.
The one by Kayla, whatever her name is?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, I read that too.
Very, very compelling, I gotta say.
Yeah.
There's arguments
against her arguments, though.
Yeah, yeah.
There's some good ones.
Well, I mean, the whole notion behind, like, for those of you who don't know what we're talking about, you can go down to the health food store and buy fermented cod liver oil in a capsule form that costs, what is it, 70, 80 bucks now?
I'd rather skate the capsule and buy it for, like, 50 bucks.
Yeah, so they're pricey. I mean, they are by far the priciest. And the whole idea behind them is that because they're fermented, right, the bioavailability is much higher to the body. Because if we ferment things, we make them partially digested, in a sense, partially broken down to the point where our body will actually absorb them much better. So that's the whole idea, at least in this point, behind fermenting that. As far as I know, with the cod liver oil, there's no good bacteria. That's not really why people are taking it. It's more from a bioavailability standpoint. But the argument says that you cannot ferment a fat. You can ferment carbohydrates. You can ferment proteins. You can't ferment fats. That's the argument. And I sort of sit on the fence with that, and I kind of wonder to myself. Because when you look at the literature behind the cod liver oil, so the fermented cod liver oil, what they will tell you is that Vikings back in the day used to have all of the livers right hanging outside the door, and they were all just fermenting, aka rotting, outside the door, and that's what they would eat, and that's what kept them so strong. Okay, and it kind of sounds a little bit romanticized to me, right? So I don't know what the arguments are against her arguments, but I don't have time to get into it. But nonetheless, it's kind of an interesting one to talk about. So fermentation is the conversion of carbohydrates to alcohols and carbon dioxide or organic acids using yeasts, bacteria, or a combination thereof under anaerobic conditions. Very, very interesting things to talk about here. I'm going to add a point here, because a big reason why people are eating ferments is because of the good bacteria. Yes? The probiotics. What type of probiotics are you going to get from fermented foods? Lots of different types of probiotics, no? Lots. We've only identified 400 so far, and we're still going. But there's two general classes. We have bifidobacterium, and we have lactobacillus, or lactic bacteria. So when you ferment something, typically what you're doing is you're fermenting it using lactic acid. So you typically are going to get lactobacillus, or lactic strains of probiotics. You're not going to get so much of the bifidobacteria. And why is that interesting? What's interesting with that is that your colon has a higher concentration and population of lactic bacterial strains. Okay, so lactobacillus strains of probiotics like to live in the colon. Bifidobacterium strains prefer to live in the small intestine. See where I'm going with that? Not to say that I'm a huge fan of ferments, like huge fan, they're great. But just saying, you know, I've run enough stool tests now, and I've run enough organic acids tests and whatnot to see what's going on in people's guts. And a lot of times, it's not the lactobacillus that they need bifidobacterium. And here they are eating all kinds of ferments, hoping for the best, and that's the wrong kind of bacteria that they need. Okay? Not to say that we shouldn't be eating them, I just think that a lot of people are like, well, you know, I don't really want to spend the money on probiotics. Yeah, I got all sorts of GI stuff going on, and I'm just gonna go with sauerkraut rather. That's good enough. I'm like, is it? How do you know? You don't really know. That's the other thing. You don't really know. Unless you're running comprehensive stool tests where you can see the bacterial composition, you don't really know what you're dealing with. But consider in cases of small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, so SIBO. All right, SIBO. SIBO is happening in the small intestine, yes? So do you need lactic bacterial strains or do you need more bifido strains? More bifido strains. Okay. Anyway, is that making some sense? Right, just to get you to think a little bit outside the box, that not all probiotics are created equal, not all fermented foods are created equal. But one thing I will say is with ferments, the bioavailability, as far as I know, is much higher than probiotic supplements. Okay, so the bioavailability. Because one of the things with probiotics, especially when you're talking about foods, we want them to actually implant, no? You want them to colonize. You want them to start reproducing in your gut. And what most probiotic manufacturers do is they will grow something. So if you imagine if I grew my probiotics on this table, and the table was the medium. So the table was providing me the probiotics with all of their food and essentially their soil to grow in. Most probiotic manufacturers will then scoop the bacteria off and they will leave the soil behind. Right, so they leave the soil behind. So now, when you eat the probiotic supplements and they get into the gut, they got nothing to root into. Which is why a lot of people say, how many people have taken probiotics and nothing's happened? They notice no differences from taking probiotics. How many people have taken probiotics and have made a radical difference and changed things around for them? Okay. Interesting. I do that with almost every class. And more of the fundamentals and other stuff. But it's always interesting to me that it's usually an even split between people that are like, yeah, I've taken probiotics, wow, I really noticed a difference. And other people, I don't know, taking it for insurance purposes, right? Because there's so many different strains living in you and there's so many different strains in the supplements. But bottom line here is when you're eating ferments, you're eating the medium, you're eating the soil, and you're eating the bacteria. Huge difference. Not to say that your gut is going to be made of sauerkraut all of a sudden, but
if you were to like, if you're making a batch of sauerkraut and you take some like pills of like bifido-based probiotics and you dump them out to your sauerkraut,
yeah,
will they multiply and flourish in there, or will it add to your sauerkraut? Or
I'm not sure, because you're talking about differing pH levels, right? Because the pH levels, here's what's interesting: the pH level in your digestive tract will vary between 5.8 all the way up to 7.2. And a lot of bacteria, like probiotics and that, are very, very narrow in terms of where they can survive, which is interesting. So I don't know. I mean, I don't know if anyone's even looking at that. But nonetheless, you know, again, are ferments a bad thing? Absolutely not. All right. Another thing that I want to come to here is, look at this. The conversion of carbohydrates to alcohols using yeasts. How do we feel about ferments and candida? That's an interesting one, no? It's like, yeah, start eating more fermented foods. And I'm like, whoa. Do you have candida overgrowth in the large intestine or is it in the small intestine? And not just that, by feeding them alcohols and yeast, are we then inadvertently feeding the candida as well? There's a huge school of thought that says yes. So for me, when I'm doing candida cleansing with people, phase one, no ferments. Keep it out the picture. And I would much rather go with probiotic supplements because there's no alcohols, there's no yeast, there's no nothing. It's just bacteria. Okay, so a little bit different way of thinking about it there. Yeah.
This is a really random question, but kombucha.
Yeah.
Why can some people drink kombucha and completely find others get gas and bloating and all that? Is that because of this? Like, is it candida?
Possibly because there's dysbiosis. Usually when people tell me that I can't live without my probiotics, yeah, red flag right away.
Mm-hmm.
Probably dysbiosis. Because your bad bacteria are like this, and your probiotics are just keeping them like this. So as soon as you stop, whoop. So I got to keep taking them. Ideally, you should get to a point where you don't need to actually be taking probiotics all the time to help your digestion, right? You should just be able to get that from fermented foods. And also remember that good bacteria are fermenting fiber to produce all sorts of other stuff, right? So before we had probiotic supplements, we were getting all of our probiotics from the soil and from food. That's changed a lot now. Yeah, now people are relying more on supplements. And last time I checked, there were 726 different probiotic supplements in North America. FYI. Kind of crazy, right? So that's just some, you know, some stuff there, background stuff on fermented food. Some examples here. This is a real short list. Miso, yogurt, sauerkraut, natto, kimchi.
How can you get more bifidus in your diet without using supplements?
Fiber. They feed on fiber. That's their fuel source. If you don't have any fiber, and you're feeding the bad guys sugars, fermented proteins, all sorts of other stuff, the bad guys just start to grow, and the good guys are trying to crowd them out the whole time, but they don't have any fuel to keep them going. So fiber is usually a good way to go. Okay, any other questions with that? No? Let's take a quick break and we'll talk about modern food processing after that. Food processing, and we're going to talk about quite a few things actually. There's some things we'll spend a little bit more time on, other things I really just want to give you the short story and keep rolling. Okay, so the first one, let's talk about pasteurization, especially in light of the video that we watched. And also consider that pasteurization in Canada is 100% mandatory. All right? Dairy, especially, dairy is not the only thing that's pasteurized, but all dairy has to be pasteurized legally. Anyone heard of a guy by the name of Michael Schmidt? Yeah, if you haven't heard of him, he's a local guy. He's a dairy farmer, right? But raw milk guy. Trained in biodynamics and organics from Europe like 30 years ago. So the guy's running like a really good quality operation. And he's been embroiled in a battle with the government for the better part of 10 years. Because he was selling unpasteurized milk and they said, no, you can't do that. So what he then did was he said, okay, I'm not going to sell it. What I'm going to do is you guys can buy shares in the cows. And it's your cow. You just have to come to the farm and you can pick it up. That's it. And the government said, nope, you can't do that either. And so he's been pushing and pushing and pushing and pushing, and is still pushing right now, basically saying that raw milk is much better for you if it's coming from healthy cows. Okay, I would not drink industrial farmed, right, giant feedlot operations. I would not drink that milk raw. And therein lies the debate. Because a lot of people, when they say, well, you're going to get killed if you drink raw milk, what about all the bacteria? What about all the stuff? And what they're thinking in their minds is what they've been told, that cows are, the milk is dirty, the milk's got this, it's got toxins, it's got all sorts of stuff in it, right? But it's like, how the cow's being raised? Yeah? If they're being fed garbage and they've been chained in a little stall for their whole life and fed antibiotics and whatever, yeah, that milk is probably no good. And I would for sure make sure it's pasteurized. But huge difference between organic, grass-fed, humanely treated, pastured, whatever kinds of cows. Okay, very, very different. So what is pasteurization? Right, so the process of heating liquids for the purpose of, technically speaking, not necessarily destroying viruses and bacteria in their entirety, but really just to get, instead is intended to reduce levels, to the point where they will not cause disease. Right, so we're not talking about full sterilization. We're talking about using heat, and it's always done on liquids, right? Solids are not really pasteurized, although they're starting to do it a little bit with almonds and stuff like that. Right, so we really want to just get the bacteria, the molds, the yeast, if there's any viruses kicking around, get those below the point of causing human harm or disease. Yeah.
I grew up on the dairy farm, and we just, you know, they went outside, and you could taste it in the milk, the difference in what they were eating. And then I went to visit a friend in the city, and I drank their milk, and I thought that it's water, like this.
Yeah.
You know, there was such a difference.
Well, and also then, of course, it is watered down to get your 3%, your 2%, 1%, 0%. It's all taken fat. Different fats off, right? Or the amount of fat, which waters it down, essentially.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But yeah, it's very, very different. Very different. You know, they've done studies with the Amish communities, right? And the Amish have 25 to 50% lower incidence of food allergies and immune problems. And a lot of it is because they're consuming raw dairy, right? So raw milk and whatever, fresh straight from the cow. And the other one is because they're exposed to so many different types of bacteria and pathogens working on a farm. So even the woman and stuff like that, everyone is exposed. The kids are all exposed to everything all the time. And their immune systems are actually strong, right? Keeping them strong.
Brent, I was going to say, even at the farmer's market, so at the end of the season, we start pressing apples. And I was selling unpasteurized apple cider, and the inspection agency came into the markets and took anybody, you know, said you've got to get that off the table.
Yeah.
Even though there's a demand for it, right?
Yeah. Well, and this is the thing, you know, the government, I don't know how to frame this, but we're essentially living more and more in the nanny state, where they're trying to protect us, but not really listening to what people actually want. You know, if more and more people, I mean, you know how many people have rallied around Michael Schmidt? Because they've watched videos. I mean, that was just a little glimpse into the Pottinger study. But people, before pasteurization, everyone was consuming raw dairy, no? Up in the Himalayas, in Africa, wherever it was all raw. And people were not dropping dead of diseases because of the food. That wasn't really happening, right? But now, with the way that we're raising these animals, the quality of the dairy, that's where problems are coming in. But the government, in their mind, are looking at it through a very narrow lens, which is strictly through industrial operations. They haven't really looked at the organic stuff and the pastured stuff. And, you know, so that's why I think we still have one rule for everything. Hopefully that changes. So how do we pasteurize things here? Just using dairy as an example, because that's really what we're going to be talking about. It runs through a tube. Okay, so essentially like a metal pipe. And it goes over a heating plate, and then it goes directly onto a cooling plate, and then straight into a bottle. Okay, this is the last thing that's done, whether you're doing beer, whether you're doing juice, whatever it is. This is the last thing that's done before actually packaging that up. And you can control the flow rate, so how slowly it moves over the hot plate, and you can, of course, control the temperature. Right, and that's really it. So it's a very simple procedure. There's different types of pasteurization here. So we have the flash process, which is 2 seconds at 185 degrees Fahrenheit. What was the temperature that enzymes were destroyed again?
118.
Okay. You see anything that's below? No. Okay. Another interesting question here is, at what temperature are probiotics destroyed? Because aren't they also heat sensitive? Don't you have to keep your probiotics in the fridge for the most part?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And why would we want to consume raw dairy? Well, the probiotics is one reason, yeah? Those are the immune building properties. So we've got 15 to 40 seconds here at 165, and then we've got our 30-minute process here at 146. Okay, so temperature goes down, time goes longer. That's really what we're talking about. So the flash method is the most common for beer, milk, and juice, and liquid heated quickly and cooled quickly prior to packaging, which we spoke about. Everyone understand the process here? Yeah, go for it.
Have you ever met anyone that like was lactose intolerant but could do raw milk?
I personally have not. No. But you might find that that could be the case. I'll explain why, because pasteurization does something to the lactose.
Is 146 degrees Fahrenheit legally the lowest temperature you can go? What if?
I think so. I don't know of any other methods that are longer than that. I know what you're getting at, right? Because then you could really drop it to below 115 and do it for 5 hours, and there you go. I just kind of wonder what would happen to that, because you're exposing it to a lot of heat and air for an extended period of time. I don't know. But yeah, food for thought nonetheless. Okay, so it's not on there. At 118 degrees Fahrenheit, proteins. Okay. So good thing to talk about here for 1 second. Enzymes are proteins, by the way, in case you didn't know that. Enzymes are proteins.
All of them.
All of them. All enzymes are proteins.
Yeah.
There's specialized types of proteins. And when we talk about being denatured, right? So we've been framing things a little differently. We've been saying, enzymes are destroyed, right? Proteins are denatured. When you start looking at the structure of proteins, what you will see is that they all have these shapes, right? Okay, so they fold over each other and they get all of these weird, like 3D kind of shapes. And the shape dictates what the enzyme will do, right? Enzymes work on a lock and key sort of basis, right? So protein digesting enzyme will never digest a carbohydrate because it's the wrong lock and the wrong key. They don't fit together. So when you denature an enzyme, essentially what you do is you take the unique shape of that enzyme and you change it. That's all that denaturing is. You change the shape of the enzyme. And if you change the shape, it doesn't work the same anymore. Does that make sense? A really good example for you to get your head around that is think of an egg. So when you cook an egg, right, so I heat up the pan and I'm gonna fry my egg, and I crack the egg open and it's white or see-through and liquid, yeah? And as I start cooking it, it gets more white and it gets firmer, yes? That's protein being denatured. Okay, in that instance is not necessarily a bad thing, but when it comes to enzymes, different story altogether. Because they will not function anymore.
When you say the argument that if someone says they get denatured by the hydrochloric acid in your stomach anyways.
By what? The enzymes? Are you talking about enzymes or are you talking about
enzymes and any proteins?
Well, that's why I say it's not necessarily a bad thing. But think about this for a minute, right? If nature is very, very smart, right? If an apple falls off a tree, the apple starts to rot, yes? What is it in the apple that does the rotting?
Enzymes.
Enzymes. And why does it rot?
Why does an apple rot? Falls on the ground. What's the purpose? To procreate, no? Because how are you going to get the seed out from the middle if the apple doesn't rot? So nature, very smart like that. What would happen if I now somehow magically got rid of all of the enzymes in the apple and left it on the ground? It's not going to rot. Some little critters might eat it, but it's not going to rot. So when we're talking about, coming back to the point here, when you look at something like dairy, for example, right? Nature has provided in the raw, whole form, the enzymes necessary to digest the food. If I come and outside of my body, if I denature that and I destroy the enzymes, that means that I now have to produce more enzymes to break that down. And think about something like lactose. Yeah, lactose is sugar, right? We need lactase to break down lactose. But my lactase enzyme naturally declines as I get into my late teens. 90% of the global population, lactase enzymes are rock bottom by the time you're a teenager. So if I'm consuming pasteurized dairy the whole time, where are the enzymes coming from? Who the hell knows? Could that be one reason why there are so many people that are lactose intolerant? It comes back to your question. Could there, you know, do you know people that can handle raw milk versus pasteurized? Because again, there is the lactase enzyme naturally present in the dairy that at least is going to help you digest this. Okay. Does that answer some of the questions? And there's no, you know, there's no hard and fast rules here. Because yes, you are correct. HCl naturally denatures things, but that's a necessary biological process. And it's also being denatured by acid versus being denatured by heat.
Yeah, so I know a lot of the skeptics will say like the enzyme supplements will not help. Just for that point alone.
Yeah, you should talk to a whole bunch of my clients.
Yeah.
They might disagree with you on that one. Enzymes are chemistry, man. Period. Right? If you work in a health food store and you want to reel people into your clinic, give them enzymes, magnesium, or B-complex. They all work. It's biology. Period. It's great, though. You get the guys come in and they're like, oh, man, feel super stressed out, I can't relax. You give them magnesium and they come back 2 weeks later and they're like, oh my god, this guy's like a miracle worker, no? It's just magnesium. Relaxes muscles in the body, like that's all it does. B-complex drives the Krebs cycle, it's going to give you more energy. If you've never taken one, you will feel like you have more energy. Same thing with gas and bloating. If you have dysbiosis and all sorts of crazy stuff going on, enzymes are going to be partly the solution. But if I eat a protein and I take a protease enzyme, biology says that the protease will work on the protein, period. There is no question. Because HCl doesn't work. HCl is not an enzyme. That's another important point to make. It's not an enzyme. It's an acid. And its sole purpose is to actually activate the pepsin. So if you put pepsin in a beaker, HCl in a beaker, and HCl and pepsin in a beaker, the HCl and the pepsin together work the best. Anyway, getting sidetracked, but nonetheless, good talking points. Okay, so what do we think here? What do you guys think? Some of the negative effects of pasteurization. What do you think there might be before we throw up the list?
Enzymes are killed, denatured.
So enzymes might be denatured, which is what we've just been talking about. What else? Give you the list. What else? Negative effects. Sure. Can destroy nutrients, can alter nutrients as well. Okay, so let's have a look at the list, since we have no takers. Inactivation and destruction of enzymes. Right? So lipase enzyme is going to break down fat. And of course, dairy has, by nature, lots of fat. And phosphatase there, which is an enzyme that's involved with ATP production or energy. Okay, so a little bit outside the box and not a super, super important point, but just generally speaking, inactivation and destruction of enzymes. I might even add to this list here, lactase enzyme breaking down lactose. alteration of calcium. Here, the same old argument being banging on about. Where are you gonna get your calcium from? Oh my gosh, you don't have dairy. Your bones, you're all gonna have osteoporosis. There is so much that people have no clue about when it comes to that. Because here's the thing with calcium, right? It's not just about how much calcium you put into your body. It's about how much you can actually put into your bones. So when you start talking about the alteration of calcium, another way of framing that is that the calcium from dairy is less bioavailable. Right? Pasteurization has one thing to do with it, but there's something else. So I have a dairy allergy that I figured out in like 2004, and since then I've done a lot of research on dairy, like a lot. And there's so many things that people don't talk about. And I'm not talking about, oh, it's made for baby cows and blah, blah, blah. I'm not talking about that. If you look at your ratios here, right, ideal ratios in the body, you should be looking at around, I'm just going to give you my ideal ratios, 2 to 1, 2 to 2 to 1. Right, some might put this as 2 to 1 to 1. Okay, so this would be a 1. I prefer 2 to 2. It's, hey, we all need more magnesium. Everyone needs to chill out. So this is ideal. All right? This is ideal. Here's what people don't realize. There's a reason why these are in a very close ratio. Because calcium, by nature, is chalk. Right? Your caltrate, your Tums. So if I eat this chalk, what will happen is that I need something to actually make it in a soluble form. Otherwise, it stays in a solid, chalky-like form, right? And here's the takeaway. Magnesium keeps calcium in solution, right? It actually makes calcium soluble, which means that I can utilize it. If I look at milk, if I look at cheese, this is going to differ depending on what the cheese is or what the milk is, but roughly they're all kind of the same. This might be up to 100 loves cheese. Yeah. It's an interesting thing. We're all allergic to it, secretly. So what do you see? Yeah, if I've only got 1:10 instead of 1:1, what happens to all the excess calcium? Sure ain't going into your bones.
Deposits
in soft tissue. Yeah, so now we've got calcification of soft tissue. I had a lady that came to see me 2 years ago. Holy smokes, never seen anything like it in all my life. Got referred to, I work with a couple of doctors, right? So got referred to me by the doctor. He's like, I don't know what to do. Like, here are the x-rays, what do you think? I was like, whoa. Calcification of the aorta, calcification of all of the arteries. Like, you can see it on an x-ray. Heavy milk drinker. Yeah, lots of oxidation going on, lots of free radical damage. So think about that for a minute, right? Any calcium that you can't actually use has to get deposited somewhere in the body, and there's a growing body of research that is suggesting that excess body calcium, okay, not excess bone calcium, excess body calcium is actually involved with all chronic degenerative disease. Which is a weird thing. There's a lot more to the picture. It's not just about dairy. There's antioxidants and inflammation and whatnot as well. But here's the other thing. If I don't deposit this in the soft tissue, I then have to get rid of the calcium, yes? Which is the organ that regulates minerals in the body? The kidneys. Okay, so the kidneys control mineral balance in the body. So now, all of the calcium has to get flushed out through the kidneys, and if it's too much, you start getting kidney stones. Isn't it funny that 80% of kidney stones are calcium oxalate stones? 80% calcium oxalate stones. Isn't it also funny that heavy milk drinkers are more prone to kidney stones?
Make sure you get lots of calcium.
So there are people like, you know, who are not milk drinkers, but even then they are found with the kidney stones sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes they're not necessarily calcium stones. They can be other stones as well. Okay. Also, not just that though, there's other things that can be happening, like in the case of osteoporosis sometimes, where your body's pulling too much calcium out. Hyperparathyroidism is another one, where your body's pulling so much calcium out the bones that the blood levels keep rising, and so the body has to get it out. And that's another way that you can get kidney stones. So, we have the highest rates of dairy consumption, yeah, the highest rates of calcium supplementation, and the highest rates of osteoporosis in North America. Isn't that kind of crazy to think about? Yeah, we're getting lots of calcium. We need to start getting more magnesium, and we need to check our vitamin D levels. Yeah, isn't there an epidemic of low vitamin D? 80% of calcium deficiency is related to vitamin D deficiency. So here we are slamming back calcium like it's our job, but we're vitamin D deficient. So the vitamin D's job is to put the calcium in the bone, yes? To stop the kidneys from getting rid of the calcium. That's what it does. It holds onto it. So if you don't have vitamin D to balance that out, nothing's going to happen. Right, so just a little bit there on questions. Just a little bit there on dairy and calcium here for 1 second. All right, next point, alteration of lactose into beta-lactose. So what this is here, right, just to give you the skinny on this, lactose is a sugar, we know, right? Beta-lactose has a higher glycemic index. Okay, it has a higher glycemic index, which means it raises your blood sugar faster. So what happens if I pasteurize, yeah, convert to beta-lactose, and then I skim the milk? So now I cut all the fat down. Nice sugary drink, no? Anyone have kids so you try to get rid of the milk and they just freak out?
No.
Common thing I hear. You know, I stopped trying to, I told them that we're just getting almond milk all of a sudden. Kids freak out. No, they want the dairy. Yeah, and they want the dairy because A, we're likely allergic to the cow's milk, is one thing. Okay, and I also wonder because of the sugar. Next one, destruction of lactobacillus bacteria. Yeah, really, destruction of any kind of probiotics that are in there. Destruction of immunoglobulins. Right? Immunoglobulins. These are your Igs. Right? So your Ig, whatever, IgA, IgG, IgE. I come back to the Amish, and anyone who grew up on a dairy farm, so my other side of the family, they're all Irish dairy farmers. I tell you what, people just don't seem to get sick. Yeah, drinking raw milk. This is also why you might have heard of something called colostrum before. Has anyone heard of that?
Yes.
Colostrum is really the first milk of the cow or whatever animal it is, right? Moms produce colostrum as well. And that first shot of colostrum, that's what has all of the immunoglobulins. Okay, it has a lot of those immune boosting properties, immune fortifying properties, and so on. Okay, last point here, loss of vitamin B6. right? Just disclaimer on my part. Again, I think that commercially raised animals, the milk should be pasteurized. I think it's dirty. I just don't think we should be drinking it, that's all. just leave it alone. I say this because here's what's going to happen, right? You're going to go home, and around the dinner table tonight, you're going to start talking about some of this stuff, and you're going to get shot down in flames. That's what's going to happen.
Oh, yeah? Hold up. Quick Google search. Oh, yeah. This is what the government says. This is what World Health Organization says. They're still recommending pasteurized milk. Who the hell are you? Because people are not looking at the bigger picture. That's why. All right, so let's talk about something else here with dairy, just to add to the situation here. And something called homogenization. Right, so homogenization in Canada is not a legal requirement, first of all. Okay, you do not have to homogenize milk. You will actually see on the store shelf non-homogenized milk, non-homo milk. So what we're talking about here, mechanical treatment of the fat globules. Okay, a good visual for you here is think about your hose with a sprinkler head on the end. Right, that's really what we're talking about here. We're pushing milk through a hose, and it's got a sprinkler head with tiny little holes all over it so that it comes out like a fine mist. I'll tell you why they do that in just a second.
You said it's not legalized.
No, you don't have to do this. But a lot of them do. And I'll tell you why in just a second. So when you do this, you basically decrease the average diameter of the fat globule. So if I took a fat globule this size, and I pushed it down a hose, and I broke it up into 500 different streams, essentially what we're doing is we're fractionating. We're breaking all of those big fat globules up into tiny, tiny little fat globules. So this results in an increase in the number and surface area of the fat globule. And absorption of fat globules through the intestinal tract before they can be completely broken down, possibly resulting in damage to blood vessels. Have any issues with butter either. I think butter is butter is awesome. Also, it's not like we're sitting down and drinking 3 cups of butter a day. That's the other side of it all. Well, maybe if you're on the, you know, the bulletproof diet or something, then a cup of butter with a little splash of coffee. Butter, yeah, butter stands on its own, I gotta say. And, I mean, the Heart and Stroke Foundation is still recommending that we eat margarine. It's like, kind of have to wonder, right?
Yeah. So you don't find people that are lactose intolerant
have an issue? No. The only people that may have an issue, and I do know a few, are people that are really, really sensitive to, they have a dairy allergy. Okay, so they're actually really sensitive to the proteins. Because when you make butter, you basically are concentrating all the fat, right? It's fat, 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 and then there's a little bit of milk proteins left over. So if you're very sensitive, you'll react to the milk proteins. But the way that you make butter, you're actually getting rid of all of the lactose. So people who are lactose intolerant are typically not reacting to butter at all. And if you really wanted to take it to the next level, you could go to ghee. Ghee has like no milk proteins at all. It's just strictly fat. Okay? So that's a little bit here about homogenization. Why do we do it? The only reason why we do this is for consumer appeal. That's it. There's no other reason. Because if you've ever seen raw milk, right, what happens is the fat globules are all different sizes, right? And if you let it sit, you'll see that fat floats. So the fat goes up to the top, and traditionally speaking, what you would have to do is you'd have to give the milk carton a shake, or the bottle a shake, and then pour it out, right? So that everything's evenly distributed. But here, we don't like that. We're lazy. So if I homogenize it, I make all the fat globules the same. It's evenly dispersed so that when I open the milk up, it pours exactly the same every time. So any reason why we homogenize anything. Incidentally, when you take raw milk and you skim the fat off, what's left over at the bottom here is your skim milk. Right? And then you can control how much fat do I leave in. This is your 2%, this is your 3.8%. You've got your cream, which is your 10%. Okay, and then of course you've got your heavy cream, which is much higher than that. Does that make sense? Yeah? Okay. Anything else on dairy first, like while we're here? So I'm gonna move on. All right, so let's move on here. And let's talk about the refining of grains. The refining of grains.
Actually, sorry, I do have a question on dairy.
Yeah, go for it.
Okay, so similar to how you were explaining the difference in the law about organic farming and how far they have to be from each other, right, and non-organic and inorganic. In regard to free range and organic, is there a law stipulating how much space constitutes as free range?
Yes, there is.
Yeah.
It's, but there's also loopholes in that.
Right, that's...
Yeah, so free range could mean that they're, it's not so much about the size, it's about how much, how many hours they spend outside.
Right.
So then you start getting people who have like, oh, I'll build a roof and the roof will be open at the end. So that's
free range. Exactly.
So now we're good, right? There's a lot of loopholes like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I don't know all of the intricacies
with
all of that, but yeah, you know, there's definitely cause for concern, especially as we're starting to see the organic movement get so much more traction, right? People are really into that. So farmers are definitely trying to bypass this.
Yeah, and then in addition, like you have, let's say, Nestle or whatever, that's a commercial brand of milk that people, like now they're coming out with all their organic, so it's like, okay, do they have a separate barn for each cow in there? Are they feeding in the same place? And
this is why I don't like buying from big companies.
Right.
If I can help it, I'll always support smaller companies.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I was reading, I forget where I was reading it. Oh, it's in the news right now. The whole dairy thing, Donald Trump. You know that that's happening, right? So Donald Trump, if you don't know what's happening, Donald Trump has basically called out the Canadian dairy industry to say, hey, you guys are undercutting the market here. Like, because we won't take American dairy, first of all right? Except there's a loophole. So because they use bovine growth hormone in their dairy, right? Recombinant bovine growth hormone is a genetically engineered growth hormone that they feed to animals to get them to produce more milk. That's been banned in Canada. So because of trade agreements and policy, we actually don't import that milk as is, but this is what's going on right now, is in February Canada changed the laws, because the loophole that existed before was something called ultra filtered, I think it was, or micro filtered or something like that. It's a process that they would do to the dairy, and because that didn't fall under the trade agreements, Canada was still importing that type of dairy. Okay, so we, up until February, we were still importing this micro-filtered or highly filtered milk or whatever it was. And then they closed that loop in February. So that's why Donald Trump is up in arms now. Because now we're actually importing no American dairy at all. At least milk. I don't know about cheeses and stuff like that. Which begs the question, so hear me out on this one, because I've been thinking about it since I read it. Have we inadvertently been getting dairy with bovine growth hormone in it?
Mm-hmm.
Because I thought no, until I read the loophole, and that I looked into the politics of it all, and I was like, oh, that's why they're freaking out. Not because of the bovine growth hormone, it's because of the ultra-filtered milk situation going on. And so then I'm like, wow, we banned that in Canada.
We're importing it.
Huh, funny. And I don't know, I'm gonna go look into it more.
I was just gonna say, because like 2 years ago I looked into it and like we were still importing, like as long as it wasn't actual dairy, if it was in any other product. So like the cheese, like cottage cheese even, like the macaroni and cheese, like the modified, like anything,
with
as long
the
as it
was powders and all that
actual
stuff.
Milk, that was the only thing that we weren't importing. So and I called like governments and I talked like the dairy farmers of like Canada, like everything. So like they said that like one of the things that they were trying to do is like there's like a symbol you can put on product that will say like 100% Canadian dairy on it. So like your cottage cheese, if it has that like logo on it,
okay,
then that has like nothing imported from America with the growth number in it. But it's not mandatory to have that like sticker on there. Just a lot of companies were choosing to put it on there. So like if you like sometimes I think it was like Cracker Barrel cheese or something would have that sticker, but then like your like no name, like President's Choice,
yeah,
like wouldn't have it. So that was like the loophole.
Kind of interesting, right? Yeah. There's still a lot of people that subscribe to that. Hey, we never got any bovine growth hormone in Canada, hurrah, hurrah. But it's like, we're importing a lot of stuff from the States, and where are the loopholes? Yeah. So, we'll just, I'll give you a brief intro here with the refining of grains, and then we'll talk about some of the implications after lunch. So first of all, we're gonna use wheat here, but all grains have a very, very similar anatomy. Okay, every single one of them. They all have, you might want to take some notes here. They all have the bran. Your bran contains all of the fiber. And most of the minerals. Okay, which is a key point. We all know that bran is fiber, I think, at this point. So all bran. Your germ. Right, so this central portion here. The germ contains the oils, or the fats of the plant. And your fat-soluble vitamins. Okay. Mostly vitamin E. Your endosperm, which is the biggest portion here. The endosperm is what contains some minerals, but that's where the carbohydrates, or the glucose, that's where that is, right? So the carbs, the glucose, the energy is in the endosperm. Yeah, so the bran contains the minerals and the fiber. The germ contains the oils or fats, and your fat-soluble vitamins, especially vitamin E. And your endosperm contains some minerals, but your glucose or carbohydrate or energy, whichever one you want to use there. Okay, that's in the endosperm. So when we refine a grain, because a lot of people, we always say, oh, you should cut out the refined grains. Cut the, oh, they're bad for you. And it's like, okay, why? Yeah, what? How do you refine a grain? Oh, I have no idea. Why is it bad for me? I'm not really sure. They're low in fiber. Well, yeah, that's part of it. Okay. So when you refine a grain, you essentially split this grain up into its three separate parts. Okay, that's what refining grains actually means. You'll sometimes hear them called polished grains. Yeah, you polish them. You take off this husky layer, right? It's not very shiny, and you polish it up, and you're left with the shiny endosperm. This endosperm is what is your white rice, okay, your white flour, your white bread, is really all it is we're being, we're eating lots of this here, lots of this, and I'm not 100% sure why we take the bran out. It's a very weird thing. I've never, why? Like, why don't you just leave it in there? And I think that some of it has to do with taste and texture, I think. Because you notice whole grains are a little bit more hardy, a little bit rough, right? Whereas your white grains typically are, hey, light, fluffy. They bake a better bread, that's for sure. But the reason why we remove the germ is so that the grain doesn't spoil. Right? Because this oil here will go rancid. So once I harvest, once I mill it, if that oil is in there, it's going to go rancid and it's going to affect the flavor of the grain. So that's why we take it out. And what's interesting is that your vitamin E, in case you didn't know, is a natural antioxidant, yes? It's one of the major antioxidant vitamins. And when you remove the germ, we now have to add back antioxidants. And typically we use a synthetic form, we'll talk about this later, synthetic form called BHT,
mm-hmm.
Okay, which mimics vitamin E, almost identical. So we take out the germ, we take out the vitamin E, and we put BHT back in to preserve everything.
Sorry,
BHT, sorry.
Oh, no.
For the chicken scratch. Yes, this is a preservative. Yeah, we'll talk in depth. In depth later about BHT. I'll give you the scoop on that. Very interesting molecule, if you will. All right, so let's leave it at that. We'll talk a little bit. I've got some bullet points and stats for you.